couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire, and a look back at Leprechaun, The Windsors, Megaforce, and Missile to the Moon. I'll also be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring a look back at Annihilation. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on other social media, I'm at Blue Sky and Mastodon at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's kick off the news by talking about the box office last weekend. Kung Fu Panda repeated at number one with over $30 million, which is really good. It ended the weekend with almost $108 million in its coffers. And then Dune Part 2 eased less than 40% to $28.5 million, and it cracked $200 million last weekend. Arthur the King did okay. It made about $6.5 million to come in third, and that's significant because it placed, and it's going to make back its money. But it's interesting, too, because it's one of those uplifting films. It's one of those heartland movies that Mark Wahlberg likes to make. But what I found interesting about this one is similar to Ordinary Angels, where it didn't have this pervasive, in-your-face religious message, it got less traction. The same thing with Cabrini, which came in at number five with just under $3 million. It's doing okay for what that is, but even though it's about elements of religion and it's released by Angel Studios, not having that overt political or religious message in the forefront has softened its box office a bit, or at least has people less interested in it. And then number three was Imaginary, which is doing fine for a horror film. One Life came in at number eight, which actually not bad that hit the top 10 with $1.7 million. And then the American Society of Magical Negroes came in at number nine with $1.3 million. It got terrible reviews out of the film festivals, and it was not marketed much at all. So that's interesting to watch. Now, on the Dune front, I forgot to answer this email I had gotten a couple weeks ago from John. I don't know where he's from. It doesn't say. But his email reads like this. He goes, "I'm incredibly disappointed with your review of Dune 2. This is not about your love of the 80s version coloring your opinion of the new movie. The podcast is about fat guys at the movies, yet you reviewed the new Dune movie and not a word about the sandworm popcorn bucket. Sad." You're right, John. You're absolutely right. I have not mentioned the sandworm popcorn button. And the thing is, these popcorn buckets are, I think this is the new push. And there's a Ghostbusters one out this week. There was a Kung Fu Panda one, because I see them at the concession stand when I go past the movie theater. And the Kung Fu Panda one is like a kind of like a wok with a bunch of figurines in it, and you get it for the kids. The Ghostbusters one, there's one with Slimer, the green ghost, and his big mouth is open. And it's got one of those traps. Actually, the Ghostbusters one looks really cool. But yeah, a lot of people have talked about the Dune sandworm bucket. And I mean, what else can I say about it? I'm interested. I've not gotten one because I'm not going to blow like $20 on that. But, you know, the full review of that is going to go when I start my podcast of Fat Guys After Hours and talk about what you can use for that one. Apparently, the sandworm teeth of the Shai-Hulud are not as strong. I wouldn't make a Chris knife out of those because they're apparently very soft, so you can reach down and you don't slice your hand open while you're trying to get popcorn. But yeah, we all know about the sandworm popcorn bucket, and that's about all I can say on the radio about it. The last piece of news, have you been following this whole British royal stuff? I'm not a big royals fan. I'm not talking about Kansas City Royals. I'm talking about the British Royals, the Windsors in England, and Buckingham Palace and Kensington Palace and Frogmore Cottage. I really don't follow it, but I do entertainment reporting, so I got to read the headlines. And this stuff is just bonkers. It's sad that King Charles has been diagnosed with cancer, but they're so cagey with what they're saying. And now this stuff about the weird conspiracy theories about Kate Middleton and is she alive? You know, she went to the hospital for something. And then I see all these people saying, well, maybe it was a hernia operation. Maybe it was for Crohn's disease where she had to have this operation. But she was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And I'm like, I get it. You know, the royals have the greatest healthcare on the planet and, you know, they're going to be pampered and everything. But 2 weeks in the hospital is a long time for recovery. And then the fact that she's kind of hiding and they had this Photoshop thing with the pictures and now they're going back and finding old, which of course it's Photoshopped. You got a person with like four entitled brat kids who are probably running around and you can't control them. I mean, there's a lot of families out there who've got three or four kids that are like, yeah, it's impossible to get everybody to smile for a picture. We did in the 70s though, doggone it. Anyways, that has inspired one of my reviews this week, and we'll get to that later. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer is for Furiosa, which is the latest Mad Max movie, which doesn't star Mad Max. It's a Mad Max saga. And that comes to theaters on May 24th.
My mother was magnificent. And he took it all from me.
Who do we have here?
She's from a place of abundance. This is our destiny.
My childhood. My mother. I want them back.
I want them back!
It looks like it's trying to really build off the good juju from Mad Max Fury Road, which I enjoyed, but the people who said that was the greatest movie ever and the greatest theatrical experience, I don't know what you were smoking. Mad Max Fury Road is fine. It's good for what it is, and it was exciting to see. It was not the best movie of that year. I don't even think it's the best movie in the Mad Max franchise. Honestly, that would go to... Well, I personally like Mad Max. The original one is good. The Road Warrior, or Mad Max 2, is also an icon of the early 80s. And Furiosa looks fine. I have to question, when does this take place? Because Charlize Theron, in Mad Max Fury Road, she had met Mad Max. But Mad Max was like in his 30s when the apocalypse happened. And the society was still there at the beginning of Mad Max. So how old is Mad Max supposed to be in that? And now this is like when Furiosa was a girl and the apocalypse had already happened. I don't know. It bothers me when you take something that's a well-known thing in a series and then really start messing around with the canon and the timeline that it doesn't make any sense. So I have a hard time believing that Mad Max in Mad Max Fury Road was like 80 years old, but that's the only way it works out. But still, it'll be a good action movie. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Acolyte, which comes to Disney Plus on June 4th.
Someone is killing Jedi. It doesn't make sense.
What happened?
I sensed darkness.
This isn't about good or bad. This is about power and who is allowed to use it.
What is that?
I'm looking forward to this one. And I'm not looking forward to this one because of the reasons other people are. There's a lot of people who are like, oh, it's not going to have digital effects. It's going to be mostly practical. That's fine. Good digital effects are fine. And I think a lot of the Star Wars movies, especially the TV series, do a decent job adding the digital effects. I'm also not dying to see something that's like Andor. I thought Andor was kind of boring. I like the idea of making grown-up stories. But you have a big galaxy and a big universe to deal with, so let's do more. What I'm most interested in is this is apparently the Old Republic. I mean, prequels. And that's the kind of stuff I want to see. They've got generations of stuff that they can mine and play around with that they really haven't in terms of visual media. So that's why I'm looking forward to The Acolyte. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Leprechaun and the Windsors. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, and we're going to jump into the movie reviews. And I'm a week late on this one, mainly because St. Patrick's Day was on this past Sunday. And as any good Irish lad would, I had my Guinness, and I made corned beef and cabbage, and got some good Irish whiskey, and we enjoyed family. And then we watched Leprechaun, because that's what you should do if you're Irish. Because you know everybody in Ireland watches Leprechaun. So I like terrible movies. I like cheesy 80s and 90s horror movies and 70s horror. I like the cheese. I like that low-level stuff that, yeah, I mean, it's not going to win Oscars or anything like that. And what's funny about Leprechaun is I have a long history with this movie. It goes back to 1993 when I saw it in theaters. A friend of mine and I went to go see it. We were the only ones in the theater. If that shows you how popular of a movie Leprechaun was. But I don't think I've really covered it on this movie, and I want to kind of talk about it. So an evil leprechaun trapped for a decade escapes to terrorize a small town.
My ear! He got my ear!
You got the back door, right? Look out, it's in the cabinets.
Toward the basement, toward the basement.
We're like really scared. Hello? I need the police. This is an emergency.
Leprechaun.
It's out. It's out of the crate.
What I find fascinating about this movie is it was just a throwaway movie in the 90s. It was just a turd of a film that they threw out there as essentially an offbeat slasher movie. And they got Warwick Davis, who at the time was best known for playing Wicket, the Ewok, in Return of the Jedi, and then he played Willow in the movie Willow. And he was a young man at that time. In fact, I think he was a child when he played Wicket. He was even smaller when he was a kid. But he's a short guy. And he's gone on to do a bunch of different things. He does stuff with Ricky Gervais. He did Harry Potter. He's done a lot of character acting. Aside from Peter Dinklage, he's probably one of the most famous little person actors out there. And they got him to do Leprechaun. And you know what? The guy made a killing on it because they did like six movies. They did Leprechaun and then Leprechaun 2. And then they had Leprechaun in the Hood and Leprechaun in Space and Leprechaun Back to the Hood. And those movies are god awful. Leprechaun in Space is terrible, incoherent, but even worse is Leprechaun in the Hood. But God bless Warwick Davis for just milking the money out of it, because he made that role his own so nobody else could play it. But what's so fascinating about this movie is it's just a throwaway horror movie. It starts out great, actually. I mean, it's cheesy and corny and low budget, but the first couple minutes of the movie are actually quite good. I mean, they're like I said, it's not Shakespeare or anything, but it's about this guy who brings his leprechaun back from Ireland, and the leprechaun's trying to affect him with magic and kills his wife, and all this great sort of setup. And then the leprechaun gets trapped. And the next thing happens is Jennifer Aniston shows up. And the movie just takes a bad turn at that point. I mean, Jennifer Aniston, nothing against Jennifer Aniston, but this is one of her earlier movies. This is before she did Friends, before she got her nose job. And she played that very typical teenager. I'm like, oh, I wish I could go to L.A. where it's so cool. And I mean, she's like, there's a scene in there where she's going down the stairs. It even shows up in the trailer, and it's a close-up of her feet, because she's got shoes, and she's wearing L.A. Gear shoes. And nobody wore L.A. gear in L.A. The only people who wore L.A. gear, the only people who wore L.A. gear were people who wanted to be in L.A. So her character is just terrible, but it is still a fun little silly movie. It's like 90 minutes. It's a lark. I enjoy it. I watch it every year, but I'm usually a couple drinks into the Irish whiskey and Guinness by that point. So I don't know what this movie would be like stone cold sober, but anyways, you know, I mean, the first scene, like I said, teases a decent 90s horror film, and then Jennifer Aniston shows up and it all falls apart. But I still enjoy it for how stupid it is and how much of a fun little lark it is. And my kids are like, I can't watch that movie anymore. You show it to us every St. Patrick's Day. But I still say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews. Because of all this Kate Middleton stuff, and because of all this King Charles stuff, I decided to go back and talk about a series that I watched, and I don't think I ever talked about it on the show. It's called The Windsors, and you can find it on Netflix, at least the seasons proper you can find on Netflix. It's a fake sitcom. It's a spoof of the royal family. And they did three seasons. Apparently they're going to do a fourth one, and they did a special for King Charles's coronation last year, which isn't on Netflix, but you can find it somewhere on YouTube from what I understand. Wink, wink. Anyways, so let's talk about The Windsors. This sitcom parodies the life of the royals in British soap opera fashion.
Wills and Kate, most popular royals ever.
This is getting out of hand.
The line's very clear. First me, then William, but me first.
The only six fools stand in the way of the Parker Bowles dynasty.
Why didn't you tell me you had Ebola?
It hadn't been confirmed.
But it's Ebola, Kate! Ebola!
Just got recognised. They thought I was Mick Hucknall, but, you know, it's close enough.
We've outgrown our usefulness, like nipples on men.
I'm as important as a nipple on a woman.
This could turn into a full-blown constitutional crisis. I don't know what that means.
The reason this is interesting to me now is because the focus on the royals has really ramped up. I mean, you had, of course, you know, the marriage of Kate and William, and then things ramped up a little bit more, and then you had the birth of the kids, and then you had Meghan Markle show up, and that caused more things. And then Harry had this split, and then he wrote his memoirs, Spare, and you had the death of Queen Elizabeth and the coronation of King Charles. So, and now you've got all this stuff with Kate Middleton spinning out of control again, and just rumors of affairs between Will and some other person. But it's fascinating because the royals at their heart, they're an entitled family. I mean, they're a very wealthy family that are completely out of touch with reality. And I find it funny that both William and Harry kind of were like, well, we're going to go find a regular commoner. And I used to kind of like Harry because he was the outlier, but I was doing some reporting on him with his book Spare, and he's just as entitled and shallow as everybody else. And of course, you've got Meghan Markle who needs to have that attention, but is getting it in a very different way. And what's so funny is one of the things that comes out in Harry's book is he talks about how every morning they'd wake up and they'd come to breakfast and they'd be all worried about what the British press was saying. And it's clear that they're still trying to manipulate the narrative and failing at it. And then they pull back and they're hiding, and it just generates more bad stuff. So what's so funny about this show is it's an absurd take on the posh, rich royals, and they play around with stuff like the character of Camilla is kind of like a Bond villain. And unfortunately, the actress who played her passed away last year, I think. But she's very funny because she's this conniving, controlling character, and they bring in Prince Anne, who is almost like this ghostly figure. People are like, oh, it's cold in here, and then suddenly Anne will show up. Characters are so absurd and so out of touch, and that's what makes it so funny. If you have any interest in the royal family or you follow anything with the royal family, check out The Windsors. You got three seasons on Netflix. Coronation special you can find somewhere on YouTube. It's absurd and it's silly, and this farce just has a lot of fun with the royal family, and I had a lot of fun with it, so I'm gonna have to say The Windsors totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm gonna be talking about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire and Missile to the Moon. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the big one this weekend, and that is Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. The new Ghostbusters must stop a threat of spirits trying to unleash a frozen apocalypse on the world.
For the first time in New York history, a room full of people froze to death in July.
It's an unimaginable evil. With the power to kill by fear itself.
Like, literally scared to death?
Now it's headed straight for us.
Is something trying to get out?
Many things.
It's commanding an army of the undead.
I think we're all going to die.
The Ghostbusters have had such a rocky road because the first movie was so good. And you can watch it today and get the same amount of enjoyment out of it. But after Ghostbusters came out in 1984, it was a huge hit. It spawned cartoons and breakfast cereals and a whole bunch of different things. And then they did Ghostbusters 2 in 1989, which was 5 years later. And that was a long time between sequels. Usually sequels had 2 or 3 years between them back in the 80s. So they took 5 years, and it was rough getting a sequel. And while Ghostbusters 2 is fine, it's a watchable movie, and I enjoy it, but it's not nearly as good as the original Ghostbusters. It drops the ball in a lot of ways. When you have a movie like this, when you have some these quirky characters that have to come together, in the original movie, part of the story is the quirky characters coming together. And that propels the plot, and that propels the character development. When you get to a sequel, everybody already knows everybody. Everybody's been established and been developed, and so you don't have to spend that time. And so you either have to develop them further in a way that was not what was appealing initially, or you have to throw a monkey wrench into their situation. And, you know, whereas like something like a James Bond movie or an Indiana Jones movie, you don't need to develop the character because it's just an adventure. Whereas Ghostbusters, at least the original part of the journey was seeing these characters come together and kind of realize what their destiny was, so to speak. And then they did, went 30 years and ended up then doing the Ghostbusters reboot in 2016, which was awful. That was terrible. And then they did Ghostbusters Afterlife. And I really liked that one because what they did is they brought in a new generation and they didn't just mimic the original film. You know, it takes place in like Oklahoma in the middle of the plains, whereas the first one took place in New York City. But they also brought in some nostalgia and they made it connect to the original film. This one, they're already in New York City. And in a lot of ways, this feels like more of a homage to Ghostbusters 2, where they're struggling to find out what they're doing. And they're making the Ghostbuster science, the stuff that people are doing, it's more established, whereas it was kind of this fringe thing at the beginning where they just, this one guy knows how to do ghost trapping. And so in this one, they do the same thing where it's this sophisticated and they've learned more about the science, but they're not very good at their security. But the writing just seems kind of all over the place. I mean, individual scenes are good, and there's plenty of ghost busting going on, and those scenes are fun, and the characters are fun. But like, there's one character, the girl, who's played by McKenna Grace. Her character runs into another ghost, and this ghost and her have discussions and stuff. I'm like, well, that's really not how the ghosts worked in the first movie, or the previous film. You didn't have this very pragmatic ghost who can chat with people. It's not a betrayal of the original movie. It changes the rules. And you're like, well, this isn't the same Ghostbusters, is it? If you can just sit down and play chess with a ghost. Almost feels like they had this as an idea for a series. They wanted to do like a 6-episode streaming series. And it's funny, another friend of mine had gone and seen it and had posted this on social media. He said it felt like a TV series, and it kind of does, because it feels almost like this episodic thing. And it's not that the movie's too long, because it's still like well under 2 hours, but it just doesn't seem to have the dramatic through line you need in a movie. And then, of course, you have all of these nostalgia things. You bring back Bill Murray, who has, and that's supposed to be a surprise in the movie, but it's all over the trailers and in the posters. And of course, you've got Ernie Hudson is already a big role in there. Dan Aykroyd has a sizable role in this movie. Andy Potts. They go for the nostalgia, but the nostalgia, it's almost at odds with trying to tell this new story. And they pull against each other. So, I mean, while it works for what it is, it just... And I guess here's one of the things that does bother me about the movie is sort of the purpose of this is there's too many ghosts in their giant storage facility. And they're like, well, this might be a problem. I'm like, wasn't that exactly what was going on in the first movie? It's almost like they forget that entire Twinkie discussion. Do you remember the Twinkie discussion? Here's the Twinkie discussion in the original movie.
Well, let's say this Twinkie represents the normal amount of psychokinetic energy in the New York area. According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie 35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.
How did they forget that that was in there? This didn't gel as much, and I was kind of disappointed in it. But, I mean, it still works. It's passable entertainment, but it struggles between the nostalgia and adjusting the series canon for the new group. I'm still going to say it kind of rocks, but it's a little rough.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Missile to the Moon. This is an older movie. I think it's from 1958. And I swerved into this because I was going to talk about Leprechaun Origins, which I started to watch because I watched Leprechaun and I started watching Leprechaun Origins and I dozed off. And I go, I'll finish it. And I came back and I had almost an hour left. And I'm like, I don't want to finish that movie. Leprechaun Origin is terrible. I was 20 minutes in, no Leprechaun so far. And I just couldn't bring myself to finish it. So I turned on Riff Tracks. And this is one of the first films that Mike Nelson riffed for Riff Tracks. It's the oldest one. And he does it with Fred Willard, rest in peace. And it's very rough from a riffing standpoint, but the movie itself is very rough. A scientist builds a rocket in his backyard and travels to the moon, where he encounters a mysterious civilization.
This is the countdown to Scream a Second Suspense. Blast off! Rocket to the most astounding science fiction adventure of the age, as man reaches the moon and discovers a world of terror hiding in the vast void of outer space. See giant rock people who guard the sun. See a dwindling race of love-starved maidens who have the power to control man's every desire.
In the 50s, anybody could just build a rocket in their backyard. That just seemed to be the thing that happens. And there were no worried about what oxygen fuel or anything like that. Nope. You just had a rocket and you just kind of lit it on fire and you went up. If you know anything about space, it takes a lot of engineering to get to the moon, because if one wrong turn, you know, you can't just kind of backtrack. But this is silly. This is very corny 50s filmmaking. And it's got a lot of stuff in it. I mean, it's got the homemade rocket, it's got escaped guys from jail who end up as unlikely astronauts. It has a civilization run by women on the moon, which seemed to be very popular in the 50s, that needed to have subservient men in it. There's a giant tarantula on the moon, giant rock creature. So there's some stuff going on in the film. It's not a good movie. But watching it on Riff Tracks with Mike Nelson and Fred Willard makes it funny. But what's interesting about it is it's a slower riff, because, you know, once you got all three of the riffers, Mike Nelson, Kevin Murphy, and Bill Corbett, they have a rhythm, and he hadn't fit this rhythm. This was when Mike Nelson was kind of going it alone as a riffer, trying to build this before it kind of became this Riff Tracks empire. It's a humdrum installment in the 50s version of DIY space travel. And it ignores science and reality as well. But it's not a good movie. Even like, you know, this is around the time of Forbidden Planet. Forbidden Planet's a much better film. But this looked like it was done for about $50. So it kind of sucks. But it's fun with Riff Tracks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Megaforce and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Annihilation. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Megaforce. There's a reason why I'm doing some of these older films, because they're just not screening anything. I'm just going to vent a little bit about the industry, and that's part of the reason next week's my last show. They don't screen stuff anymore. I remember back in the day when I was a young pup doing the reviews 20 years ago, and you'd have two or three screenings a week, at least, of major films. And over the years, they've become less and less. And then COVID hit, and they really stopped screening stuff. Now, the award season, you know, like October, November, December, there's a ton of screenings. I'm constantly going to screenings then. But that's because everybody wants you to see their movie for award considerations for you to vote for it. We've had two screenings in my hometown of actual screen movies in Columbus, Ohio, which is a major city. Everything else, I got to go kind of on my own dime. And I know Immaculate opened this weekend. I didn't get a chance to see it. I can't see everything if I got to see everything on like a Thursday in order to do this show. So, yeah, I'm dipping into older ones. So, yeah, I'm going back and looking at some old standards and checking those out. And maybe I'm going to open your eyes to something completely stupid and cheesy, but a lot of fun. And with that, let's talk about Megaforce. An elite international squad uses motorcycles and rocket launchers to defeat terrorism in the 80s.
From the director who brought you Smokey and the Bandit, Hooper, Cannonball Run, comes the ultimate spectacle. Megaforce, an elite compact fighting unit armed with the most sophisticated weapons ever seen on a movie screen. The mission, to preserve freedom and justice and battle the forces of evil.
The good guys always win, even in the 80s.
What's funny is Megaforce came out in 1982, and it's directed by Hal Needham, who's best known for doing, and I think it says so in the trailer, like Smokey and the Bandit and Cannonball Run. So he was known for these, I guess, comedy action type movies of the 70s and 80s. And Smokey and the Bandit's a lot of fun. So's Cannonball Run. But Megaforce was his sort of pseudo-serious military-type movie. And it stars Barry Bostwick as the leader of this elite group of people. That's, for some reason, they're like international. They're a bunch of people from other countries. But they're fighting for America? Question mark? Because they're somewhere out in the desert. And Henry Silva plays the bad guy who's the terrorist, but somehow they're friends. Because when they have sort of like a white flag truce meeting at times, and they're good buddies. The elite fighting force, they all wear these sort of Lycra or spandex jumpsuits, and so you see everybody's moose knuckle. And you realize that Barry Bostwick has no butt whatsoever. I mean, you know, you've got some people who've got a sizable caboose. There is no junk in Barry Bostwick's trunk. This was made at the time of Xanadu, where a lot of the movies, it just kind of had to have the spectacle. And look, I like the explosions and it has the action elements to it, but it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's hard to tell where the good guys are and where the bad guys are in terms of what alliance they have, because there's a British guy who shows up and he's sort of overseeing them. Again, I don't know what the overall structure, and it apparently it takes place in the 80s, because at one point there's a line, again, you hear it in the trailer, where he's like, the good guys always win, even in the 80s. And I'm like, well, this is made in 1982, but it feels almost futuristic. So unless it's just like 8 years in the future, I don't even know if they know what time the movie takes place. It's a mess of a movie, but it's silly and it's fun and it's steeped in the 80s, and it makes no pragmatic sense from a military standpoint and no pragmatic sense from a vehicular standpoint, because I don't know how the machine guns don't stop people on motorcycles. Go figure. But cocaine, spandex, and 80s jingoism all collide in this insane look at Homeland Security. I wish our Homeland Security was like this, with flying motorcycles and headbands and all taking place in the desert. It's an insane movie. I did watch it on Riff Trax. I will say they've got a great Riff Trax on it. But you know, the original version of Megaforce is also quite good. Even without it, it's a little rough to get through because it's really stupid. But it's still a fun dose of 80s cheese. I'm going to have to say that Megaforce kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week I'm going to look back at a movie, and I'm talking about it because it's getting a 4K release this week. And that is Annihilation. It's a movie that came out a couple years ago. It's directed by Alex Garner, who's got that movie Civil War coming up. So they're sort of tying in. A lot of times when you have a movie coming up, they'll release library titles. I think Annihilation, this is from, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. It stars Natalie Portman and Jennifer Jason Leigh. It came in theaters, and it's been on Netflix for a while. They've got the rights to it, and so I thought I'd give it a shot, because what I did is I read the book, or I listened to the book. I take walks and stuff, and I got the book, and I listened to it, and I want to talk about that. So a group of military personnel and scientists travel into a space-time anomaly that is expanding into America.
It was his decision to go in. It's something they termed the Shimmer. We've sent in drones and teams of people, but nothing comes back.
But something has.
You're a biologist.
You served in the military.
If I knew what happened, I could save his life.
The boundary's getting bigger, it's expanding. We're talking cities, states.
You need to know what's inside. So do I.
When I saw the movie, I didn't like it the first time, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And then I read the book, and I understand what they're doing in the movie now. It's not that the book explains anything any better. The book is still kind of a mess. And I say it's a mess, but that's kind of like part of the point. It's written with an unreliable narrator. You know, one of those things where you can't trust what the narrator's saying because the narrator's being affected by this anomaly. And so as she's, you know, reacting to stuff and describing things, you don't know if what she's seeing is real or if she's being influenced. It seemed to be one of those unfilmable books that they tried, and it wasn't a terrible success in it. And the movie itself tries to make it a little more linear. And that's a mistake because it just makes it more confusing. If you loosen up the reins and you realize that it's using this weird form of dream logic, that makes more sense. So the book, I understood the book a little bit more, but then going back and watching this movie, I'm like, yeah, this is where the problem is there's this big chunk in the middle that we think is linear and cohesive when it really isn't. And part of it is, in the book, the characters are kind of just these archetypes in the background. Well, they try to characterize them in the movie a little bit more, and that causes problems because they're unlikable characters and they do stupid things. And that becomes very frustrating in this movie. It's got some great concepts to it. It's got some really interesting stuff happening underneath the narrative. But part of it is Natalie Portman plays this woman whose husband had gotten called as a military personnel into this anomaly, the Shimmer is what they call it. And he disappeared, and then he came back, and then, you know, so he seems to be kind of popping in and out of time, and then he's sick, and so she's going in there to, you know, sort of like find out what went wrong. But my problem is, I don't like her character. And that's honestly, for me, any movie or story, you have to like the character. I'm not saying the character has to be a good person, but you have to like the character. The character has to be likable. The main character or characters, you have to like them. You have to at least be invested in them. And you may think they're horrible people, but they're at least interesting to watch, and you're curious to see what happens. Her character, I just didn't like. I just couldn't care less whether the character lived or died. She wasn't appealing as a person or as a character, overly flawed and annoying I didn't like her. Oscar Isaac, who plays her husband, there's really not enough development with him. And that's what put me in a problem. And I didn't like any of the characters. There's one character goes in the Shimmer that I like, and she gets killed. So I'm just like, well, everyone else I just had big problems with. So even with some high concept brilliance, the confusing story and narration failed to hold the film together. I know, and it's tough because the book itself is kind of all over the place purposely. But still, it kind of makes this movie kind of suck.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. And that's it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Godzilla versus Kong, the New Empire, on my final show of Fat Guys at the Movies. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.